the road must have a code that you can live by, and so become yourself, because the past is just a goodbye. Teach your children well, their father's hell did slowly go by, and feed them on your dreams, the one they picked, the one you know by.
This is your host, Athena Melville, welcoming you to the November 18th, 2010 edition of Education Now. Tonight, I am sharing an interview with Dr. Maria Hess, recorded on November 11th, which was a beautiful morning here in Northern California. Maria Hess is an associate professor in the psychology department at Sonoma State University, and the recipient of Sonoma State's prestigious Excellence in Teaching Award. This award is nominated by students and awarded by faculty. For the last 25 years, Maria has been a psychotherapist in private practice and a therapist trainer for Sonoma County in the public and private sectors. At Sonoma State University, she teaches clinical courses and depth-oriented psychotherapeutic models. In her personal life, Maria Hess is a strong supporter of the Tibetan culture, has a deep interest in shamanic traditions, altered states, and other aspects of transpersonal psychology, and she is a blossoming vegetable gardener. During the interview, Maria talks at length about her research paper titled On the Student's Experience of Healing with an Academic Teacher. Please join me at the Education Now Facebook page to comment or leave questions. Or comments and questions can be sent to me at hermes@pacific.net. Maria also welcomes your contact. Her email address is maria.hess@sonoma.edu. And now we will get started. Hello, Maria Hess, and welcome to the Education Now airwaves. It's such a pleasure to have you here with me this morning.
Thanks so much, Athena. I, too, am looking forward to this.
Yes, it's the first time I'm getting to hear your voice, but I have heard so many wonderful things about you from your students. And I myself have sent many students to Sonoma State University, where you teach, and I always hear just glowing things about you. And so it's just a real pleasure for me this morning to get to have this chat with you.
Oh, I so appreciate that. Just warms my heart to hear about the good review.
Well, I've told our listeners that we're going to be talking about holistic education and the experience of healing in relationship to an academic teacher. So if it's all right with you, can we get started with on just what you mean by holistic education?
Oh, absolutely. For me, really what I'm talking about in looking at holistic education and defining that term is learning how to live and kind of integrate with the concept of love and spirit being at the core of anything that one does in an intentional classroom. The idea of the teacher themselves being connected with their own heart and their sense of being lined up, if you will, with their spiritual nature. Not necessarily religious, but more a sense of being connected to something bigger than oneself that kind of holds us in the classroom. For me, what I really am talking about, too, is that this sense of being connected to one's heart and being connected to one's spirit or soul also keeps us humble For me, I really see in academia sometimes that can be a challenge area where we are the ones that are expected to know things, but at the same time having to stay connected to our humility to be more fluid and connected with others rather than above.
Right. More eye to eye is what I would, in my vernacular, I would say that it's more eye to eye with others and with students rather than this looking down or looking up.
Absolutely.
Is that
I
what?
Would say that too. Yes, that's exactly what I mean. And not only eye to eye, but the whole eye. So here we go with the holistic education. Rachel Naomi Raymond made a comment that was really pivotal in my dissertation research, and it really, I kept it on my computer screen just to kind of reinforce and support me, because it was very interesting to do the research on this dissertation. It took quite a long time because there was very little written about love in particular and healing in the classroom. But Rachel Naomi Raymond and her work at with medical students, she was talking about how to bring forth the hidden wholeness is what really educators and healers share, and that for her to educate and to heal meant the same thing, because what it commands of an educator who is a holistic educator and a healer is that we both have to trust in the wholeness of life and people and then be willing to serve the wholeness. And for me, that really just like was the key to everything. Between her and Parker Palmer, they really helped set up a paradigm that made my ideas more viable, which was really lovely.
So, Parker Palmer?
Yes. Have you, Parker Palmer wrote a book called Courage to Teach. And he, I don't know if you're familiar with him. Are you?
I am not.
He's a teacher in the public school system, and he's a Quaker. And he really, in 1998, he wrote Courage to Teach, and that was the gateway book that for me really continued to spur me on, because as I had said, when I was doing my research, I couldn't find much on healing,
No. But
I could feel a ton on wounding. Volumes of people writing books about how education had maimed them psychically, spiritually, intellectually, all kinds of things. And that was a little, eye-opening. But when Parker Palmer wrote Courage to Teach, he's got several chapters about loving, just being in love with our topic, with our students, with the world, so that we feel like we're coming from a full cup rather than an empty cup.
Right. That cup that's half full, not half empty.
Absolutely.
Yes. I think possibly because Montessori talks like this as well. And
absolutely.
Pardon?
Yeah, absolutely. She was a key person.
Yes, she was a key person. And so many educators in the mainstream have felt that concepts like love are just way too subjective.
Oh, yeah.
And then today, if you talk about, even if you've been teaching for 30 or more years, and you talk about what you've learned through your observations and work with students, that just doesn't suffice.
It's so true.
They want this scientific, this left-brained, or maybe we shouldn't use that terminology even, but, they want this step-close step, linear kind of explanation for something that is a whole. It's a gestalt, is the terminology that I use, and an experience. And then when you talk about love, I think about passion. When you have a passion for the subject, when you have a passion to teach, when you see the passion in your student for a subject and you follow that lead, everything is possible.
You bet.
And
I agree.
You agree?
Oh, absolutely. And I have to tell you, I went to an alternative school. So I graduated from the California Institute of Integral Studies in San Francisco. And I went there because I wasn't entirely interested in having to prove what I knew from my own experience with teachers who had been enormously healing for me. And so I came to the study with this idea of, I didn't question at all that healing and love was important in the classroom, because it's what lit me up and it's what made my potential blossom, was to have three, in particular, there were three teachers, one who, of whom has been my mentor for now 35 years, who really, I don't know, if for lack of a better word, were proof that what I was talking about was not only viable, but happened all the time. And that from having my own experience with them, then as time went on, I was hearing more and more from students about not only their healing experiences with me, but with other teachers also. And it was cross-discipline. So when I brought back to my dissertation committee, you know, yippee-ki-yo, look what I'm finding all over the place, they said, well, you know, operationalize it. So I chose to do a phenomenological inquiry to try to operationalize some of what I was seeing and give it a paradigm, so that people who were saying, yeah, but what about all the subjective this is and that, that whole protocol really cut the mustard as far as I was concerned, and as far as my committee was concerned, and as far as other educators and non-educators as well, who can start to kind of wrap their minds around this concept of, oh yeah, when somebody feels loved, accepted, and seen, something else happens. It's not just engaging the mind, but there's something about that, I don't know, essential nature that fuels creativity and vision and the willingness to take risks, which I know in higher education I'm certainly going for. And I can tell the difference in my students who come from Montessori schools and Waldorf schools and charter schools and even some homeschooling, where their life force was kind of held as the priority, and then their education came from that. And that was a different student in the classroom.
They were validated. They had been validated.
Yes. Validated and encouraged and supported for the unseeable and the unknowable. I mean, you know, it's hard to quantify love, but there's no doubt for any of us, this is my deep belief, is I don't think there's a doubt for anyone who's been loved. I mean, once you've been loved and you feel that in your relationship, you know what it is.
Yes.
So I think for students to be willing to even answer my ad, have you had an experience with a teacher that you would define as healing, really speaks to, oh, yeah, you know. And the important thing, 100% of my data across all of my I only had 16 candidates, and I really didn't want too many more, but 100% of them said the first thing that was important is that they felt loved by their teachers. And I thought that was pretty remarkable.
I think it is incredibly remarkable. I also think about how Carl Jung talked about intuition and feeling, and you know, as well as thinking and sensing. And yet it seems that in the mainstream, once again, we do not acknowledge intuition. We do not acknowledge feeling. We do not acknowledge, you know, because those are aspects of love. It's almost like caring is too subjective for the mainstream.
And, really true.
And I have such a hard time wrapping my head around it, my brain around it, And how can we help this system, this educational system that is deteriorating before our very eyes, if there is no acknowledgement of something as basic as love?
How indeed. I mean, for those of us that come from this position, speaking for myself in particular here, it's like it's such a no-brainer, but that was the hardest thing to wrap my mind around. It's like I kept thinking that, well, I'm saying the obvious. I mean, why would this mean anything to anybody? I'm just saying the obvious.
It's a priori. It's a priori.
Yes. Yes, indeed. But, you know, I think for me the biggest challenge has been, and it's great, one of the reasons why I said yes so readily to the...
Well, hello and welcome back, Maria Hess. I'm so sorry that we got disconnected, but you were just getting ready to tell me why you decided that you would take the time to do this interview with Education Now.
Okay. So one of the things that I was thinking about here and why I was excited to have this conversation is because I've been an educator for 30 years, and I have really felt, noticed, experienced, researched the shift in academic, well, at least in higher education. And I have a lot of friends who teach little ones, kindergarten, first grade teachers, second grade teachers, and we have lots of conversations about, you know, oi, our students can't write, they don't know how to philosophically think, their critical thinking skills are this or that. We're seeing compromises and differences for lots of different reasons in our adult learners. But what I also see is that this propensity towards teaching to the test, to, you know, to kind of corral creativity, to interpret everything rather than just allow. It's like it's connected to bigger things, bigger issues. It's not just in this moment we're getting our first graders to test to this particular test, but it's a bigger issue that particular kindergartner, that first grader, when they get into my classes, and I teach upper division courses to undergrads who are preparing for careers in counseling psychology and clinical psychology. So that's my particular target group. But I see the deficits from their early childhood education when they get to me. And so one of the things that I really wanted to be able to talk with you about and just have an opportunity to say my thoughts out loud is that this push towards science and evidence-based this and that and the skepticism of subjective knowing and experience, I think really compromises individuals on a kind of civilian, being a good citizen level. I mean, impacts the ability to have meaningful conversations, impacts the opportunity to suspend judgment, opinion, belief, to kind of welcome the other to come forward. So for me, doing this research, being able to look at things intersubjectively with my researchers, co-researchers, about their experience of healing, really kind of pushed it into this bigger level of, oh yes, everything is connected. What we learn in kindergarten, first grade, does connect to the quality of life that then we want to create as adults. And it does impact us when we then go to parent our children. And for me, that's where my passion stays lit, is to advocate that spirit that by the time they get to me, if not having been crushed, is definitely covered over with several bushel baskets. I see lots of bright lights that are hidden in my students from fear. Fear of saying out loud what they think or feel.
Fear of being different and unique, and fear of not having the right answer. And it's so sad. It's so sad that teaching to the test is just destructive to the spirit of the child. And I'm using the term spirit once again, you know.
Like
my, isn't that subjective? Yes, I so understand what you're saying, and I know that my listeners are going to love hearing this, Maria.
Good, I'm glad. Yeah. It's so lovely to be able to talk with kindred spirits, because I know for myself, and this is where I can even get emotional myself, is that this notion that somehow everything has to be proven so that the unknowable,
the great mystery,
that's right. Or like Thomas Merton talks about, like the moisture, you know, the moisture of the soul, that which keeps us alive and enlivened. It's kind of squeezed out of us, and certainly not everywhere, and I don't mean to generalize in that big way, because I know there are other people like me, because I've seen them, I talk to them, and I train them. But for the most part, what I see is a lot of minimizing and dismissing of that which cannot be seen. I think that's a huge error and a huge mistake, and it only uses like such a small part of who we are as beings that it seems like kind of a ripoff in some way that we would be willing to live that way.
Yes, it is. I don't know if many people even don't know they have a choice.
That's true. Absolutely.
I keep thinking, is it from the dumbing down of our education system in the 80s, Maria, I took my children out of school, and I'll call him my husband, was teaching in at the college level, and he left the system as well. And we knew at that time that the only place in the California system, you know, the public system at the university level, where the humanities were going to stay healthy was at Sonoma State and UC Santa Cruz. And I know that people think that's radical, but it really isn't. I was so grateful to have Sonoma State there for my sons, and to know that my students could go to UC Santa Cruz. And, I, you know, as I've said, there are elements at Humboldt State, and there are elements at UC Davis. But by and large, a strong humanities base, a strong ethical base, you just can't find it in most of the system with the kind of regents that came in to the system with the education as a business, education as a business model, instead of education as part of the caring profession.
That's right. A part of the healing arts.
Yes.
really, it's, you know, I think that on the same vein, part of what I'm looking at in training people who want to be, I don't even like the word training because it's not really that. It's more offering an opportunity for another way of thinking and learning and being is really that I believe that it's on us. And it's kind of like what Parker Palmer says in this glorious book of his, is that the teacher needs to, well, maybe I can personalize this and then I can speak to it more freely. So I need to be willing to take the risk to keep myself on the front line, to hold this notion of love and reciprocity and caring and service as the priority, irregardless of the walls crashing down around me that say, what kind of educator are you? Especially in this day and age, because right now I'm really looking at what is the reason we in higher education want to train so many researchers. What is that about? All science-based, research-based, what is that about? Rather than really looking at, we need to teach as many souls and spirits as we do minds. And so for me, really being willing to say this stuff out loud, even if the wave is contrary to my thinking, and staying open to that, rather than, I mean, because, you know, I think sometimes our culture can make me want to close down myself. I mean, I believe this with all my heart, and I can still feel that part of me that says, well, maybe they're right. What do I know? Geez, you know, who knows what love is? Is this what love is? I mean, I have colleagues who say, oh, Maria, you're not studying love and healing at all. You're studying learning. And I'm thinking, well, yes, but there's something more that's happening too.
Yes.
So just being willing to keep myself a conduit for the belief of it all, for the experience of it.
Right. Stay
open. Can be
open.
Challenging.
Stay
yes.
open. Yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
So beautiful. So beautiful. If I lose you again, Maria, I will call you back. I just wanted
okay.
to, I wanted to say that, you know, just in case it happened.
Okay.
But, I wanted
you know,
to...
I, if, oh, sorry.
No, go ahead.
I just wanted to let your listeners and as well as yourself, Athena, hear some of the other things that came out of this phenomenological inquiry I did, that not only, did they find that love was important, but they also said that the relationship with their teacher where they had this experience was one of the most profound experiences of their life. That was also 100% of everybody said that. They also felt like this sense of being connected and having a reciprocal relationship, not just with the material, but with the teacher, with their colleagues in the classroom, that was also really important, that they felt like their part was equally as important as what the teacher was doing. They also felt that it wasn't just healing, but it was also transformative, that they felt like they transformed as beings. And some of them even talked about it as being transcendent, which blew my mind. And I thought that also really spoke to like Jung's concept of, you know, the collective unconscious and also just when we talk about popular science, right, the hundredth monkey. It's like this idea that when you get the goods, the opportunity to get the goods even better
yes.
Rises exponentially.
Yes, yes. Yes. can you tell us again what this research that you were doing was called, what you called it?
Well, this was it's even in the endemic in the language, but this was my dissertation that I had completed, and I did a phenomenological inquiry, and it was called On the Student's Experience of Healing in Relationship with an Academic Teacher.
Great.
And I've since written some things about it, but it's yet to go to publication. And it's also been hard to find a home for the material for the very reasons that we're talking about, even with contemporary and alternative educational journals and magazines. Lots of feedback I'm getting is, yes, 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 and where's the evidence? And that was really interesting to me.
Isn't it?
So I just continue to plod along.
Your experience means nothing now. We just want you
really
to deny
true.
What you've learned through your experience and give us some science. Give us some
give us
some experiments that you've done that you can measure.
That's right. That's exactly it.
And that's depressing.
It's so depressing. But you know, there have been amazing people that have gone before me. So, you know, I'm thinking about the people years ago in 1990 when I was, in the throes, well, actually it was about 1993, I was in the throes of writing this dissertation.
Cut us off every 15 minutes today for some reason. Skype is, and so I am just can't apologize enough for the inconvenience. But you were telling us some very important things, and if you could please continue. You had just told me about the reception that your research and that you had done, the phenomenological research with your students and their responses, and how difficult it was to get it published.
Yes. It was published by my institution of learning, but to break down the articles and then disperse it, this has been where the challenge has been. It's actually been very great for me because I get to keep my finger on the pulse and I get to see where the pockets are, but I can also see where the resistance lies. And what I was, where I was going before the Skype had its way with us, is that I had in my process of writing the dissertation, it was quite painful because I wasn't finding support in the literature. There weren't a whole lot of people I could talk to about this, although I did have committee members who were not only supportive but really, really encouraging and held me. I mean, they just cared about what I was doing and they trusted me. And so it was interesting because my whole premise was activated all the way through my dissertation process because it was difficult. So during this time, there was a conference held in Naropa Institute in Colorado called the Spirituality and Education Conference. And I went there because the presenters there were the people where I was finding material, like John Taylor Gatto, Bell Hooks, Ron Miller, Parker Palmer, and His Holiness the Dalai Lama was also there.
Wow.
And it was amazing. And there were only 300 people at the conference, which I also thought was very interesting, very telling, and spoke to the Times. This was 1993. But I went there because I felt like this was my lineage. These people were my lineage, and I needed to be with them. And I had the good fortune to meet with everyone, except for His Holiness, of course, for lunch or for a little tea, just to say, hey, look, I'm writing this dissertation on healing. Got any pointers? Because, boy, am I bummed out by this. And all of them, each one of them were so generous and so welcoming and so encouraging and inspiring to keep at it. And even in the dearth, I mean, each of them had had a similar experience as myself, being like a lone wolf in their little corner of the world, holding this notion that love and spirit is the core, and if we teach the whole being, we get not only informed and educated students, but we get, you know, more integrated parents and more deeply connected citizens and more productive insofar as doing meaningful work where they're passionately linked, which I think we can only benefit as a group by that. I mean, I would much rather have somebody not have a big, high, muckety-muck job, but boy, are they happy about being there, than supporting somebody whose soul is lost to them for six or seven figures. I mean, to me, it's just a no-brainer. But I'm thinking about, you know, the bigger quality of life, and I'm also thinking about it psychologically, not necessarily from these other avenues that other people feel more comfortable in.
Right. Yes, I think you need to. I'm so proud of you, and I just hope you continue to keep on keeping on, because it's important work. And everyone who's ever contributed anything really meaningful has had this struggle. I think of that. I think of Montessori and many others. And so, I'm just so glad you're there. And I just hope you do keep on keeping on.
Now, well, thank you. I appreciate that.
Now, you had mentioned a woman at the very beginning of our conversation. I think you said Naomi?
Oh, Naomi, Rachel Naomi Raymond.
Rachel Naomi Raymond.
Yes.
Uh-huh.
And she's an educator at U.S., I believe it's USF Med School. And she teaches, I love her classes, Being Human 101 to doctors. and it's wonderful. I mean, this was in the day, so, you know, I don't know if it's currently being taught, but I do know that as of the late 90s, that was certainly something that she taught. And she really, she's just got this really down-to-earth way of talking about being connected and loving and healing in a way that is non-threatening. And her whole idea is that to be whole, to be authentic, to be genuine, all of those things that are integral to humanistic psychology for sure.
Right.
It is really part of her foundation in the way she teaches medicine.
Right.
Which I think is incredibly inspiring.
Right. Oh, well, you know, authenticity is just such a subjective word.
Yes.
Oh, even though
it's totally
as a teacher,
true.
I recognize it. I recognize
yeah.
it when a student, when another being, I'm in their presence and the authenticity is there, I recognize it.
Yes.
You know?
Well, you know, here's an example. I teach a class called the History and Systems of Psychology, and I'm teaching the second component of it, which is humanistic existential and transpersonal psychology. And in my class are young 20-somethings, 19, 20, 21. And we just did an exercise this week where I asked them to first have a conversation with one other person and then move to a group of three and have another conversation and then five and have another conversation and then come back into the larger group, which are 25, for our last conversation and just see the quality of differences in communication and being heard and listened to. And at the end of the class, there were several students who came up with tearful, just like, thank you so much. This may be the first time in my life where I really experienced someone listening to me. And for me, that was like, whoa, it's good. I'm glad by 20 you had somebody listen to you, because that seemed to make a qualitative difference for them in that moment. Because not only could they experience what it was like to have it, but then their experience of being validated that they hadn't had it before also came into play. So there was a part of them that they had always kind of known, but they then were able to say, I've never been listened to that way. I like this way better.
Yeah.
So then the opportunity to create those meaningful conversations, those meaningful dialogues, that seed got planted. And I thought, now this is the reason why I teach.
Yes, and that would be transforming. That would be transformational and transcendent if you'd never felt listened to.
Yeah.
And then suddenly you felt that someone was listening, and here you were 20 years old, and all of your life you had never experienced this. That would be transforming. That would be transcendental.
Yes, it changes the world view and then allows the possibility for other things to happen. And who knows what it would be? I mean, it might be magical. It
right.
might be very practical, but nonetheless, it opens the door in
right.
a different way.
I've had students when a new student recognizes that you are actually listening, look at me in the eyes, and then with the biggest smile, just of, you know, unable to believe it sometimes.
It's really true.
Or even if you're listening to their behavior, and if they're, if you reflect, reflective listening is what we called it in my training. And if you reflect behavior, and you and you're right, the student just says yes. You know, it doesn't. Sometimes it's not words that when you're listening, you're listening to their whole body language. Do you find that?
Oh, and not only body language, but their whole being. I mean, we were talking yesterday about an experiment that I've asked them to do, and I'm doing along with them, which is for 1 week, instead of saying, how are you, we're going around saying, how's your soul? And we're noticing how it changes things right from the get-go, because I'm getting like, soul? What do you mean exactly? Just that alone has really, just in the few days that we've been doing this, has really started changing all of us in our discussion, like, wow, what does it mean really to come into meaningful contact right from the very beginning around this notion of something that we all possess, whether we can see it or test it or not, and really move into that, oh yeah, well, how is my soul? And where does one go to answer that question? Just to look at that and change the worldview of this kind of mechanistic, especially now with the iPods and the iPhones and people walking together and while they're texting, but they're not talking to each other.
Yeah.
It changes the whole quality of connecting. So just being able to experiment and pretend we know stuff, looking for new answers and ways to be, I think is very exciting. And, you know, for me, one of the hopes that I had in doing this with you as well is the opportunity to really just offer a vote of support and inspiration and encouragement, because I think particularly for early childhood educators, we forget to pay homage and offer respect to what an incredible incredible job that is, and how difficult it is to try and teach children in an environment that takes it for granted and doesn't really respect what it calls into being for the person who does that work. And I just wanted to, you know, be able to kind of be one of the voices of this lineage to say, you know, keep at it. And what we do matters on all the levels that we do it. And to keep the heart open and to be able to talk with each other and stay connected to the lineage, even if the environment says no, that we stay connected to the heart of why we teach anyway.
Yes. I think that most teachers who are still doing it are doing it for that very reason. There are so many great teachers out there, and they're not being respected. And they open up their hearts and souls to students every day in overcrowded classrooms without the materials that they need.
Yeah.
Without the material support for their efforts, and constantly being criticized, and my I just want to I'm so pleased that you brought that up, because they're the ones that really need our love and our concern. We're reaching that 15 minutes, and if it dies on us again, I'm calling you back, Maria.
Okay.
So that, you know, we can really conclude this meaningfully. I want to be sure that we that you talk about influences in philosophy and psychology. You've mentioned these two people, and if you would do it again, the two books, Naomi, I keep...
Rachel Naomi Raymond's, the material that I got about her was from this wonderful book called, it's a compendium, called Healers on Healing.
Healers on Healing. And then
Healers on Healing.
And then the other book.
You know, the Divine Comedy.
Yes, A Challenge from the Universe.
Yes, there you go. That's really true.
How flexible can these women be? And I think we're doing quite well.
I do too. So, well, you know, going back to some of the written material that's available with these ideas.
Yes.
Ron Miller wrote a book, What Are Schools For? And I thought that was a really instrumental book.
Ron Miller?
Ron Miller.
What Are Schools For?
Mm-hmm. And it's a historical overview and a commentary about some of the primary educators that your listeners are probably very familiar with, John Dewey and Maria Montessori.
John Dewey.
Some of the other big thinkers about education, and Paulo Freire and other great thinkers. And then, of course, bell hooks. Teaching to Transgress is a really wonderful book as well. And I love her willingness to be such an activist and such a forthright speaker about being a woman in academia, and really what it takes to be different and to teach from that perspective, from a position of strength rather than apology. And I think that's also important to realize, is that we don't need to apologize for believing and experiencing and knowing what we know as educators.
Right. We don't need to apologize for knowledge we gain from our own experience, which
That's
I cannot
right.
give you. I cannot give you my experience, but I know it. When
yes.
I, that kind of knowing, I know it. No,
mm-hmm.
it is fundamental,
yes.
to me, but I can't give it to you. I can't give you my experience. You have to experience it yourself.
True
and yes. Now the name of that book is called Teaching to Transgress. And the reason I want to mention it again is because our listeners will just get one chance to hear the books that you're mentioning. And so I ask you to repeat them so that they can hear it again.
And
now, are there any other influences that you would like to mention?
Well, I think the other influences that are near and dear to me are my mentors, of course. You know, Art Warmoth at Sonoma State. My undergraduate educators who opened the door. One person who I don't know where he is anymore, but Clarence Mahler at Chico State, who was the first teacher I ever heard use an explicative in the classroom.
Uh-huh.
And I so admired him because I thought, wow, he said that? And the ceiling didn't come in or anything. He started me on that path. And then Bill Rector, also a teacher at Chico State. So on a personal level, my undergraduate educators who took the risk to be their authentic selves in the classroom were really the ones that kind of carried me in. David Van Eyes at Sonoma State and Susie Stewart at Sonoma State. I have some amazing colleagues that I've been fortunate to work with for years and years, and they're
That's
all retired
that,
now.
That is why I love Sonoma State.
Yeah.
All four of my sons went to Sonoma State. And
oh, did they?
They did.
Oh, that's great.
Is that great?
Wow. That is great.
Oh, it's
so
wonderful.
You know, we're watching changes happen at Sonoma State. It is part of the state system, and so we do see changes happening,
yeah.
And there's a lot more evidence-based and science orientation, and research
right.
is taking a more forefront place. But what is also true about Sonoma State is that it does have that heart that we're speaking about today, that really kind of resonates through everybody's agenda.
Right. And at some point, don't you think that they recognize at Sonoma State that this core was missing? And so they, don't they offer a core program there? What is it called? You know, where you could, where you can, as a, when you enter, you can, the Hutchins, isn't it?
The Hutchins. Oh, the Hutchins program. Yes.
And so everything is connected. The curriculum is interconnected. And, and so a student, if they missed that, if, you know, their education was fragmented and they enroll in Hutchins, then they can get that, that holistic or that interconnected, that interdisciplinary approach.
Yeah.
At least that's what I thought. Now, my sons didn't do Hutchins. As they told me, we had that at Montessori. We're ready. We're ready.
Right,
but I had other students who, when they went on, if they went to Sonoma, did do Hutchins and loved the experience.
Oh yes, it's a truly innovative program, and you know, in all fairness, what I have learned over my time at Sonoma State is that when I see different departments overall, I mean, surely, you know, there are concentrations and there are particular departments that I might not generalize to, but even the faculty, even in those departments that I wouldn't generalize to, do have a sense of their students as human beings.
Yes.
And coming from that, you know, humanistic tradition of teaching all of them. And even if it's not in the philosophy of humanism, it's definitely in the modality of student-centered learning.
Yes, I agree with you so much. I loved it that Mario Savio was there.
Oh, absolutely.
And I was just crushed when affirmative action came down. And I think, you know, that was a crushing moment in education for many people and easy to lose heart.
That's right.
But, well, is there anything else you want to tell us before we end this interview, which I have enjoyed so very, very much? Is there anything that you feel you want to say before we say our goodbyes?
The only thing that I would like to say is that I'd love to be available to your listeners, and if anybody would like to contact me via email and continue the dialogue or share their experiences, I would really love that. That's the only thing I could think to add.
Okay, so that's maria.hess@sonoma.edu.
That's it.
maria.hess@sonoma.edu if you would like to have Dr. Maria Hess's ear. Oh, that's so cool.
Thanks, Athena, for finding me. I really appreciate the opportunity.
Well,
thank you very much.
You came very highly recommended, and I have told our listeners before we started this interview that you are the recipient of the prestigious Excellence in Teaching Award, that you were nominated by your students, and it was awarded by the faculty. And I just wanted to say, while I had you on your ear on this phone conversation, how prestigious that is, and what a great and wonderful compliment it is.
Yes. So it was very touching.
So
thank you.
Thank you so very much.
You bet.
Bye now.
Bye-bye.
It was so delightful to talk with Maria Hess, and in spite of the technical difficulties, I had so much fun, and I was very excited to share her with all of you. Once again, contact information for Dr. Maria Hess is maria.hess@sonoma.edu. The next Education Now podcast is December 2nd, 2010. Education Now is a production of the Hermeneutic Institute for Holistic Health and Education, a 501c3 nonprofit corporation. Education Now podcasts are listed on the American Montessori Society website at http://www.amshq.org. That's 3 W's, amshq.org, and look under Regional Group Events. All broadcasts can be listened to with free download at the website. Thank you so much for listening, and please join us on the Education Now Facebook page. As well as leaving us a comment or question, you will also find many updates regarding education during this critical time. Goodbye for now, and I hope you all enjoy this harvest season.
You are on the road, must have a code that you can live by, and so become yourself, because the past is just a goodbye. Teach your children well, their father's hell did slowly go by, and feed them on your dreams, the one they picked, the one you know.